Metsville and baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael Acolin, also known as the Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. And on behalf of my partners, I welcome you back to the Metsian Podcast. A third of our triumvirate is not available. That'd be Rich. The other third is available. That would be the converted Mets fan, Mr. Bedford and Sullivan, Mr. Sam Maxwell. How are you?
What's going on, Mike? Looking forward to talking some Mets baseball tonight. And it's always, I always feel good when we're talking Mets baseball, for better or worse, when I'm looking at the skyline. And that's what I'm approaching as.
And it indeed is such a nice view from where you are at this present moment. Sam, you sound like you're having fun. Mets fans are having fun. It looks like the players are having fun despite all this adversity going on. Fun time. Fun time. Ladies and gentlemen, our featured guest this evening is a reporter for nearly 20 years at New York One News, and he's a lifelong Mets fan. He is Mr. Roger Clark. Good evening. Welcome. And thank you for joining us, sir.
Oh, hey, guys. Thanks. Always a pleasure. You know, I have to talk about Mets baseball every day, all day. So this is a great opportunity and great to be with you.
Excellent. Thank you very kindly. Much appreciated again. Let's jump right in. Let's talk Mets. You know, I have a saying, you can't win pennants in April, but you can surely lose them. I think the same applies for May. The first 2 months of the season, you know, good starts help. And when you encounter rough times, you have that cushion to play with. Hopefully by Memorial Day, you know, you're in good standing and you're looking forward to a good summer. In April, the Mets went 9-11. They're presently 2-4 on this bumpy road trip, but they're 11-6 in the month of May, which includes that 7-game win streak. So there's that cushion that we're presently, sitting on and feeding off. So, Roger, how do you feel? There's a lot going on. You know, we really should be cliff-like lemmings, but there's a resiliency in this clubhouse, and these guys just keep chugging along.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, I have to say, you know, there was some dark, I'd say probably back in April and you know, early May, before they went on that 7-game streak, I was really wondering what was going on. And part of me thought, you know, I think a lot of people are talking, we're attributing it to that first weekend, you know, with the Nationals, when those games got postponed because of COVID. And then all of a sudden there was lousy weather. They got a bunch of games rained out. I really think, I do think that through the, you know, it threw them off. I really do, including Lindor, because there was so much, you know, hype about him coming back. And I think for ball players, you know, when you go through spring training, you're ready to go, and all of a sudden it's like, it doesn't happen. And I had to get into their heads to a certain extent. And I think they're still kind of playing catch up a little bit. It might sound crazy, but that's my theory.
An interesting theory. There's a lot going on, and it's so much fun. Sam, there's a grit, a determination about them. And we've already gone through the bench mob. You know, we're on third stringers already. Yeah, we got swept by Tampa.
Yeah.
That first game, the Rays won in walk-off fashion. We got trounced in the ensuing two games. Atlanta, at least we take 2 out of 3, but then again, there was that walk-off last night. And now we have something fishy upcoming in Miami. So how are you feeling? What are your opening observations?
You know, I think that for some reason while you were talking at the beginning of this, I started thinking about April in 2017 again. And I think I've kind of used that as a contrast before, in that, you know, as the injuries started to pile up, they didn't handle the adversity well after kind of, you know, treading water in April. Whereas you're, you know, to contrast, you're seeing the opposite here, you know, obviously being helped by the fact that nobody's really run away. Nobody's really gotten their act together in the division. Because even the Mets right now are holding on to a one-game lead. And partially, part of that has to do with the fact, percentage-wise, they're ahead, but the other teams have still played more games, referring to that missed national series, as we talked about. There's a lot of fun characters on this team right now, and resiliency, is basically Kevin Pillar incarnate, right? The way that he has handled getting hit in the face, he looks like a boxing champion right now, or even somebody who isn't a champion, but he is handling himself like a heavyweight right now, and it's obviously helped to inspire this clubhouse. And I want to also touch on real quick before I send it back to you, Mike, about Lindor, that it's been very uneven, and like Roger said, that the opening might have actually not really helped him get into the swing of things. But not only has he been just absolutely otherworldly defensively, and you can really see the difference in the numbers and the fact that the way they're winning, a lot of it has to do with that defense up the middle, but also you can tell that he's not letting it affect the type of teammate he is. You're constantly seeing him being encouraging off the bench, and he's the first one to the top of the dugout, to the top of the fence when something right is happening on the field. And it was something I again noticed when Tomas Nido got his hit last night when we briefly were ahead. And so, yes, he really does need to start dominating, showing the type of, because he's really getting, I think that we always talk about how defense is not valued enough in baseball when it comes to numbers or whether it's be the Hall of Fame. And so, of course, he's getting partially paid for the type of defense that we've been seeing. But obviously, when people think 341, they think offensive numbers. So that really does need to come around, of course.
Let's not forget analytics is also playing a part in positioning these days. But let's stay with Lindor. Roger, he's had 158 bats to date. He's batting 189. He's slugging 280. That's a little bit problematic. So far, I've been saying he deserves the benefit of the doubt. He's a proven star. But when does it become time to worry?
Yeah, well, I think, Sam's right about the defense. I mean, especially just something as simple as, like, double plays. Like, you see a lot of double plays. They just, they turn them. And it's those are the things that get them out of innings, and get them out of trouble. But that being said, it's kind of like with McCann, right? I mean, McCann has just been horrible at the plate. But then helped, like last night when he threw out the three Swanson, he's got a gun, such a gun for an arm. And you're like, all right, he's such a great defensive player. Oh, but he's hitting so, it's tough. It's tough. And with the catching position, thank God we have Nito. But at shortstop, I mean, realistically, I just don't think the Mets are going to, they're not going to take him out of the lineup. They can't, because it's almost like they have to prove something. Hey, we paid this guy, and so it's like, I don't know when that would possibly happen, where they would even think of taking him out of the lineup. I think he could be batting 150, but I mean, let's hope it doesn't get to that. You know what I mean, Mike?
Absolutely. You brought up James McCann. Let's go behind the plate. Thomas Nido is hitting versus the Braves in the series. He went 5-for-9. Home run, three RBIs. There was a moment in yesterday's game where, he could have produced in the ninth inning, but I should say McCann was in a position. But Nito's hitting. That's my point. James McCann, he's not hitting. He's only batting 202. And as I was alluding to, he was in that situation in last night's game where he could have done something in the ninth inning, but didn't. So, do we play the hot hand? Do we go with hitting? Or do we stick with McCann? That's what we're paying him to do. Plus, he has that arm, and he showcased it for us again. Roger.
Yeah, I mean, well, here's the thing, and it's also how do they handle the pitchers? I mean, that's a whole other story as well. Like, if the pitchers like McCann behind the plate, that is like a mental thing, and you want to keep him there. That being said, you know, think about, I mean, I just think about me growing up and the players that, you know, when I was a kid, Jerry Grody, caught the tail end of Jerry Grody, and he wasn't like a super tremendous hitter. I mean, he was okay, but behind the plate, his presence was unbelievable. He could throw runners out like nothing. He managed a pitching staff that included guys like Seaver and Matlack and Kuzman and Ryan and Genchi and all these guys. So I don't know. It's a tough one. And you see Nito, and, you know, it's almost, this is when you wish you had a DH, right? Which I'm not a fan of totally. I'm still up in the air about that. But, yeah, you could stick Nito in there as a DH, and you get that bat in there, and you still have the you know, McCann behind the plate. It's a tough one, Mike, because it's just like, I see how, I mean, that was something, when he throws out a guy at third base like that, I mean, it's amazing. But then he gets up in a spot when you want to see him come through, and then you get frustrated again. So it's like it's a typical roller coaster.
As is my habit when I host, I like to play the role of contrarian. That's why I phrase things the way I do. Sam, I'm going to throw another stat at you. Thomas Nito, since on May 1st, he was only batting .154. Today he's batting .286. Do the math. So do you see any? Are you leaning one way or another behind the plate?
Well, I mean, I guess there is something to be said for the possibility of him getting exposed. The power is there, and that is something, you know, first started this podcast, Mike, we talked about when Anthony Record came aboard back in, like, 2014, how refreshing it was just to see some power from the catching position that didn't dry up after April, a la John Buck. And so that, you know, it's, I think one of the beautiful things right now about Nito is his approach at the plate. You, of course, like I said, you worry about him getting exposed, but you got to play the hot hand. And, you know, there's no, obviously, like, his defense is very good as well. The one thing, and I'll play contrarian too, about James McCann's defense, in that, yes, he has a cannon. You know, us fans like to refer to it as Mick Cannon. There's been way too many wild pitches and pass balls with him behind the plate. And,
yeah,
you know, whether – I remember, like, at first it was Trevor May was combining with him on way too many of these. But you see it happen. And speaking of, you know, the double play, obviously that ends up taking – either that can take away the double play or a run can score. So that's something that I would like to see tighten up. As well as his approach at the plate, of course. Just, like, right now, they need to, you know, the way, like it has not necessarily, it's been an overall focus of the overall offense. But stuff, like, McCann has not been there when it comes to changing the way that he is handling these. I mean, if, you know, he's such a ground ball machine right now, that is the number one thing. Like, how do you figure out how to not hit it on the ground all the time? Try to get some lofts, you know, like where's that launch angle that we were talking about? James McCann needs a launch angle right now without it just falling into an outfielder's glove. So to answer your question as to who do I play, I think right now, you know, as long as James McCann's not hitting, you have to give Nito some more reps. And right now, you know, I think McCann's been behind the plate the majority of our losses in May. So, you know, you do the math, to quote you, Mike.
Yeah, and to that point, you know, here's my opinion. You know me, I'm in favor of a receiver first and foremost. I think the onus is on your corner outfielders and your corner position players in the infield to produce most of the offense. You know, it's just unfortunate that McCann got caught in that situation yesterday in the ninth. But as you say, he's been a left on base machine along with a bunch of others and, you know, grounding into double plays.
Before we move on, and sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but before we move on, I wanted to remember to also mention, I mentioned this on Twitter earlier, so I'm wondering whether it has any credence, but I wonder whether he gets exposed being in eighth place. I feel like he needs more protection, and that's one of the reasons why he hasn't been performing.
don't let
Good
me
point.
don't let me jump into the rabbit hole with my, you know, Central Division theory. But anyway, Roger, you want to add anything to that?
No. I'm kind of nodding my head in agreement. I mean, you know, I mean, you're starting. You guys are convincing me here without Nito playing. So
then let us complete the battery. Let's talk some pitching. Again, a cornucopia of things going on. DeGrom had his rehabilitation start today through 3 innings, no hits, no runs, no walks, 8 strikeouts. That's promising. Syndergaard yesterday through a rehab start, 4 innings, 1 hit, no walks, 5 strikeouts. So hopefully help is on the way. Jordan Yamamoto has been called up. He may make a start this weekend. But the starting rotation is being depleted before our eyes. Taijuan Walker's also on the I was going to say disabled list. How old am I? The injured list. So, you know, observations of the starting rotation depleted or otherwise, Roger.
Yeah, you know, the Walker thing is a shame because he was really looking pretty good. You know, Stroman was pitching well, and then he had issues. DeGrom is like, well, you know, it's just like, I mean, that's just the, you know, the typical, you know, it's like one of those, you know, we can't have nice things because here's, even when things are going bad, you know, even though they won't score a run for the poor guy, you know, he's coming out there. It's almost like a little bit of a holiday. You're like, hey, Jake's pitching. It's going to be okay. And then when you don't have that, it's almost amazing that they've been able to, you know, to win ball games. And which goes back to what you guys were saying earlier about the kind of team that this is right now. And you know, and even the guys they're bringing up from the minors are, you know, just, it's a good, the chemistry's there, they're gelling, it's nice. But yeah, but it stinks when you keep looking on the horizon, like, you know, Syndergaard going to come back, Carrasco, Lugo. I mean, this is some team on paper when you think about it, if we get everybody back and everybody's healthy, but it's, you know, it's kind of a waiting game. You know what I mean, Mike?
Yes, I do, sir. Yeah, Taijuan Walker was a big hit. Jacob DeGrom, you know, at least the way we were informed, we're not being made to riddle ourselves with anxiety. So, Sam, you know, starting pitching observations?
Well, you just mentioned Jordan Yamamoto, and I was wondering why he wasn't here the other day and why they keep going with Lucchese at all. I think it's clear that something's missing, whether he needs to go down and figure it out in Syracuse or what, you know. And mind you, I think he almost had it out on that Nolan Arenado. I mentioned this, I think, on the other podcast, and I don't think Nolan Arenado fouled it off, but it is what it is. I tie on Walker, that is a huge hit. But they seem to be picking themselves up. It also, with Walker, it doesn't seem, you know, we always say this, and all of a sudden, you know, he winds up on the 60 day. But it seems, you know, he was out in the clubhouse the other night. You saw him on the bench. So I don't think it's going to be that long. And that's what I do like about the fact that it's not a 15-day disabled list now. 10 days makes so much more sense. So that's good. But seeing Syndergaard pop up the other day, I mean, like, all of a sudden you realize it's the end of May and that he was projected to be here by July. So my guess is, you know, at 93 to 97 miles an hour the other day, that's exactly where you would want him in his first rehabilitation start. And can I just also throw it out there? I believe it was Seth Lugo, Noah Syndergaard, and Jacob deGrom, 3 straight days for the St. Lucie Mets. You know, part of me just wishes I was down in Port St. Lucie right now, just so I could see these rehabbing starts. But
Ernest,
I mean, Dove, the pitching.
go ahead,
take me with you, please.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna finish. I was just gonna finish with the pitching has been stellar overall. You know, it's funny to think that Jeremy Hefner, in a different alternate universe, is still in this rotation. But right now, he's getting the most out of both the starting pitching and the bullpen.
I was going to say, Ernest Dove must be having a lot of fun covering St. Lucie right now. We had him on the show earlier this year. Part of the answer to your question or situation with regard to Yamamoto and Lucchesi, I think has to do with options. Yamamoto, I believe, has the most out of him, Lucchesi, and Peterson, those three. So that's why I think Lucchesi is still here and why he didn't get sent previously to Syracuse, and that's why it probably took so long to bring Yamamoto up. He has the most options. So I think that covers that. If you want to start us off on the bullpen, I know you want to spread some love somebody's way, Sam.
You got to talk about Sean Reed Foley right here. And I believe it was in the game that Walker was removed. So, you know, like a good segue right there. There's some real unsung heroes in that bullpen right now, and Sean Reed Foley is one of them. Got to give props to Miguel Castro as well, who's been extremely flexible. The fact that Seth Lugo isn't there, this could have been really disastrous. But again, Jeremy Hefner seems to have a good sense of what each pitcher needs right now. You know, they were talking about how he even was coaching Matt Harvey. You know, they've stayed in touch. And unfortunately, just to tangent real quick, Harvey's kind of gotten a little off since coming with the Mets, and that's what was kind of bittersweet about the way we handled him the other day. But anyway, going back to the bullpen, let's give props to Diaz. I still think that, you know, unfortunately, the numbers are what they are when it comes to Diaz, whether it be back-to-back days, whether it be non-save situations. But you can't deny that he's just got all the talent in the world. When he's hitting his locations, those pitches are unhittable, completely unhittable. And it's really up to the coaches and Luis Rojas to handle him properly, because that's just, you know, again, there's enough of a track record now where he needs, you know, he also needs to recognize these things and maybe tighten up focus on, you know, just the same, like, it's basically with Edwin Diaz, it's what happens with a lot of some of these guys with the first pitch, with some of these pitchers with the first pitch to a batter. And we've seen that, we've seen the Mets be affected a few times recently, where they don't have any focus on that first pitch and it gets clobbered. So whether it be that specific, you know, any pitcher, or whether it be Edwin Diaz, he needs to stay focused from pitch to pitch. He's going to be okay.
Roger, I'm going to throw a couple of things at you here. You know, you can't be disappointed with what you don't expect. And this season, obviously, the Mets came into the season with expectations. And we're always so riddled with anxiety over the bullpen. But along with the starting rotation, you know, they're a huge reason why the Mets are 3 games over .500. That's one, you know, there's a couple of commendable performances in that bullpen to date. But Rojas, players make managers look good or bad. And right now they're making Rojas look good. In addition to all your bullpen observations, Rojas' handling of pitching changes. There's two instances. The first one was with Marcus Stroman. Handled him mm-hmm. with kid glove. And then there was Peterson's start. And, you know, he let him bore through the innings. But along the way, it seems like Rojas isn't preparing an inning or two innings in advance. When you think there should be somebody warming up, there's not. But for the moment, again, winning trumps all. And when they go on a losing streak, this might be one of the top items of discussion. What say you?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, my son plays 10-year-old travel baseball, and the coach, you know, is more on top of the pitching staff than what I've seen from Rojas. You're right. No, I'm serious. You know, actually my son was pitching the other day and he was doing great. And all of a sudden he walked up to the mound and I said to my wife, "What's he doing?" And she's like, and she had the talent because it's like, believe it or not, now you can follow the game on your phone, which is like not something that happened when I was in Little League, obviously. But and I'm like, oh, okay, you know, because they're really careful with the pitches and you know, trying to help the kids with their arms and stuff. So and I'm thinking, wow, this is pretty good. And he already had someone warming up, and he knew who it was. And I'm like, wow, why can't the Mets do that? Like, you know, but no, I mean, there was definitely like when he left Peterson in too long the other night, and that was that caused problems. And the Stroman situation you're talking about, he misused Diaz in the spot as well. I don't know, you know. But here's the thing, like, I mean, you're right, like. A couple of weeks ago, and, you know, like mid-April, we're talking about the bullpen, and everybody wants to just, like, you know, jump. And then now it's like, wow, the bullpen's great. They're keeping us in games. So it's the same thing with Rojas. It's, you know, I think it was after the brouhaha when Conforto, you know, got hit. The whole brouhaha where, you know, the bench is cleared and everything like that. And then the next day, everybody's like, "Oh, the Mets aren't tough. You know, the Mets aren't. You know, like they should have fought them. You know, they should have did something." And it's all based on Rojas being like a laid back kind of guy. So this, you know, and this is how Mets fans react to stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, like, "Oh no, he's the player's manager. They love him." You know, so I don't. It's like you keep switching. You switch gears when you're a fan of this team, and I find myself, I'm guilty too. I every week I change my mind, you know.
Sam, I want you to pick up on the Rojas point, but before you do, I just want to throw out some love. Trevor May, we're getting our money's worth. Aaron Loop, very important left-hander out of the bullpen, and you know, Familia. Jerry's Familia. You know, we've pounded on him for years, and so far so good. So, go ahead, Sam. Pick it up with Rojas, if you will.
Steve Gelbs was talking last night about how that laid-back, demeanor that everybody was criticizing Rojas for having is actually coming in handy during these moments of adversity. And you've got to say, like, I think, is there really a perfect game in-game manager anymore? I mean, I don't think we have properly given anybody we haven't properly, like, talked good about any in-game manager in years, if ever, on this podcast, considering when we started, Mike, Terry Collins was the manager. And then before that, it was Jerry Manuel and so on and so forth. But it seems like you said, like it's up to the players to make the manager either look good or look bad. I don't know whether you're going to have that in-game manager wizard anymore. Cause even Joe Maddon, who is really the most famous, widely regarded great manager that I can think of over the last 20 years, a lot of people had criticisms for him in Game 7 of the World Series, the way he handled the bullpen. So nobody's perfect, of course. Right now, we're going to continue to nitpick these little details, but I think there is credence when it comes to the laid-back approach being good for this team right now. Not to mention, he's 39. He's not even 40 yet. And I've hoped that the Mets could have somebody that grows into the job, that matures with the team, that they don't just knock to the wayside. Obviously, it's going, you know, I think whether he is going to be here for years to come will probably be dictated by whether, one, they make the playoffs, two, how they do in the playoffs, three, his performance in the playoffs, yada, yada, yada. But right now, I have nothing specific to complain about. He's at the front of a first-place team. And, you know, it was the games that his father was at where he didn't perform properly. He lost all those games. I'm pretty sure Felipe Alou was in Tampa Bay for those. So, you know, I think the last time I said that he needs to pick Alou's brain at some point, I still will say that. I think that he, for better or worse, one way or another, that he still needs to get better and continue to get better and take it game to game. But nothing overtly to complain about right now.
Well said. This is still on the job training. He's yet to manage 162 major league games. So, you know,
yeah.
a weekly update I don't think is, you know, out of line. So far, so good. The players seem to be behind him, and, you know, I think that's half the battle. They respect him. So that's a good thing. You are listening to the Metsian Podcast. Our guest this evening is a reporter for nearly 20 years at New York One News, and he's a lifelong Mets fan. His name is Roger Clark. We're so appreciative of his time this evening. Roger, at this point, I would ask you, please, and kindly, tell us about yourself. Tell us about the native New Yorker, and tell us how he became a Mets fan. Also, tell us what you do professionally and how we can find it.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, born in the Bronx, believe it or not, somehow became a Mets fan. I've lived in the Bronx, and I went to Staten Island, and I grew up mostly in Forest Hills, Queens, Forest Hills, Rego Park border, actually right on the border, and which led me to first Mets game, I think, like 1975. My dad surprised us and just took us out of nowhere to a Mets-Pirates game, and typical story, you walk through the tunnel, you see the field, it's literally the greenest thing you've ever seen in your life. You feel like you're in some kind of, like, far-off land, and that was it. That being said, though, being from the Bronx originally, my mom grew up in the Bronx, and we grew up only block 80 on 167th in Jerome. So my grandfather took me to Yankees games when I was a kid, and it was tough because my dad was a Dodgers fan. He took me to Mets games. My grandfather took me to Yankees games. I even went to some Yankee games when the Yankees played at Shea, if the Mets weren't in town. So there was a moment where I had to make a choice, like when I was little, and you know, of course I picked the right team, I think. But but I did, you know, it's funny, I got to see some cool stuff. I actually saw Ron Guidry strike out 18 on a Saturday night at Yankee Stadium, and which was a great moment. I'm glad my grandfather took me, but of course, eventually I came around and really I realized that it was the Mets that I was able to relate to them better, you know. So, and then yeah, as far as the job, you know, I do the mornings at New York One. I'm the features reporter. I kind of like do a little bit of everything and tell stories around the city. And you know, I'm up pretty early every day. I wake up at like, you know, 4:30 every morning, and I've been doing that for the past 17 years as part of the gig. And yeah, just trying to find good stories and you know, love the city, love my hometown, and keep going, you know.
And I'm a follower, and I think all the locations you talk to us from are special, and it's an enjoyable follow. So thank you very kindly. Sam, any questions for our guest?
Well, I first want to kind of relate in that I'm a converted Mets fan, as Mike referenced earlier. I basically came to New York at the height of the Yankees dynasty. And I have some memories like Scott Brosius's home run. I was at game one of the 2000 World Series, which is a weird memory to have now, considering like I'm a part of, I joined the Metsian River midstream in terms of the complaining about that series. Like, so I see it from a different perspective now. And, but like you said at the end there, you just identified with the Mets more, and that's basically what happened to me, other than the blogged story that I have out there on Converted Mets Fan. But I want to say that like one of the big things that I remember being such a difference from having lived elsewhere before I was 10 years old to moving to Manhattan, and it kind of started when my dad and my other mother were up here in 1994, that when I visited them, I was like, wait a second, you're saying that there's a Channel 1 in New York? There's no Channel 1 anywhere. So NY1 has certainly been in my life and been a part of the peripheral of my New York experience, because I'll then go elsewhere and forget that there isn't a Channel 1 in those places. so I guess if I were to have a question, what are some of your favorite places in New York City where you've gone as a reporter? I get, we'll start from there. Let's start there.
Yeah, well, you know, I always try and I like to try and find a lot like hidden gems and things that maybe, you know, even it's crazy. Even growing up here, there's still you still find stuff that you didn't go to or know about. You know, growing up mainly in Queens, you know, and you guys may agree that you kind of colloquial, like you kind of stay in your neighborhood a lot. Like we didn't really come into Manhattan to go, you know, unless it was like maybe to see this. Not even see the tree. Every once in a while, my grandmother would take me in, and we'd go to Macy's, and we go have a eat lunch at this place, Bun and Burger, and then we take the train back, and that was it. I really didn't, you know, I didn't know too much. Brooklyn, I knew Coney Island, and I knew Kings Plaza because we used to meet my aunt Lenore and Uncle Warren there for lunch at the Cookie Steak Pub. I don't know if you guys remember that place, but. Yeah, but it's so funny. So now it's like weird as an adult, like I'm learning about my own hometown more and you know, through work, you know, finding these places. So I love the parks, Sam. The parks are so cool, you know, I mean, Central, and that's obviously, you know, that's it. But places like Pelham Bay Park, I mean, I go hiking there sometimes, and I'm not really a hiker. I'm trying to lose weight and I walk, so I'll drive up there and you could walk for hours and never see the city. Like it's crazy. Fort Tryon Park, Staten Island, where my dad lives. There's, you know, there's really great places where you can go for walks on like the beach and the boardwalk is great there. So yeah, that's what I love. I love just like, and you can, you know, I get on Twitter all the time. People are like, wow, I didn't even know that place existed. I'm gonna go there and try it. Yeah. That's always the best. That's the best reward. You know, it's like I love when someone will actually like message me and say, oh, I went to that place, and it was awesome. Thank you. And that makes me feel great, you know.
I'm totally Bun and Burger.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I loved Bun and Burger. That place was so delicious.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's funny. My grandmother took me to the Empire State Building, and we went there, and, the you know, typical, like, you know, my, she's, you know, typical New Yorker, and she has no patience. So we get there, and there's a line, and this is, like, in the, like, late 70s. And she goes, ah, forget it. We're going to Bun and Burger. You can come another time.
I
okay, Grandma.
Sorry, Mike, just to wrap up, I completely relate to that. Just all these, I love these little intricate details of New York when, you know, you guys, like I unfortunately have never heard of it, the Burger Place, and now I'm going to have to look it up. But I think one of the things you also touched upon is that this place has been so swept up in urban buildup that we sometimes forget the hidden natural gems that are here that they've preserved. And like you said, Fort Tryon, and right on top of there, Inwood Park, which is the most untouched part of Manhattan at 95% original woods. I think that's one of the things. And there's Highland Park is another one where you'd never know that you're in Brooklyn, border of Brooklyn and Queens. I appreciate you talking about that. Yeah, exactly.
Love it, love it, love it.
Thank you, Roger.
No, it's good. It's good to, you know, learn. You know, I like learning, so it's good to learn every day as my job. It's kind of cool.
Very quickly, Roger, I had a similar upbringing. My father was a Yankee fan. I get my Mets fandom from my mom's side of the family. In fact, my cousin's father, my uncle, was also a Yankee fan, and both of us got our Mets fandom from our mother's sides of the family. And I spent those years in 75, 74, 75, watching both the Yankees and the Mets play at Shea Stadium. Here's my dilemma. I was overseas in 1986. I was in Germany. I'm still waiting for a World Series. I'm 54.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, you know, it's funny. In 86, I was at college at Syracuse, and you know, had it, you know, and there was just, you know, back, you know, I didn't really have that much cash or anything, so it wasn't like I was going to come home, buy tickets to a game, and hang around. So, you know, I watched it, you know, on TV, you know, in the dorm up there, and, you know, and there was a lot of Boston fans, of course, because a lot of kids from Massachusetts went to. So that was definitely probably the greatest ever, was watching Game 6 with a bunch of kids. There was one kid from Vermont, and there was one kid from Boston, and they thought they had that game, and then it turned around, and it was the best. They were just looked like, you know what I mean. They were not happy. But
yeah.
It was tough to watch in the same room with a bunch of Red Sox fans, but it was definitely worth it when we came back.
Yeah, of all the luck, I was overseas, and I'm still waiting for my World Series. What was I going to say? I drew a blank. Let's get back into, this is what I was going to do. We hadn't planned on doing this. We do numbered episodes as well as standalone. And we set this one up as a standalone. But if we were numbering them, this would have been number 78. We recently did episode 77. What we do is correlate the show number with the Mets season. Covered the 1977 season in one of our previous episodes. Next one to do is 1978. Being that you were there and experienced it, with the recollection that is etched in stone, like myself, what were your feelings in 1978 as a young Mets fan and the onset of what we call the dark years?
Yeah, at that point, Seaver was my idol, and of course, that went out the window. And even I think, like, the Mets traded Matlack and John Milner. Like, it seemed like all the good guys they were getting rid of. And then they brought in, a lot of journeymen and guys who, were okay but really not that great. And I remember, you found yourself rooting for, like, anything. I think, was it, like, Mike Vail? He went on some kind of, like, hitting streak, and it was, like, a rookie hitting streak. And everybody was going crazy. And then I even liked, back then I liked Lee Mazzilli, and I loved Dave Kingman until one time, it was weird. I was waiting in the Shea parking lot, and I saw Dave coming out of the stadium, and the guy was 6'6". And I went up to ask him for an autograph, and he basically ran me over. Like, he didn't even, I don't know if he saw me actually.
Wow.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Apparently he was not the friendliest guy. Yeah, that's what I heard.
I hear he was pretty bipolar.
Yeah,
that was a rough year.
That was a rough year because you started to see. But one of my first autographs was John Stearns, who of course wound up being really popular as a coach. Later on,
the dude is my favorite Roger from that era.
He was great. I mean, he was. I still remember when there was a collision with Dave Parker at the plate. I think it was. And, Stearns had played, I think, linebacker at Colorado. He was like a football – it was unbelievable. I mean, he was just tough. That was the thing. Like, I loved baseball so much, and I would, my mom was pretty loose about stuff. So, I would take the subway by myself, pay $2 for an upper deck seat, try and find the orange ticket, sneak downstairs. I'd get thrown out of the seat 4 or 5 times by the ushers until finally it was, the fifth inning, and they gave up. And then, and I would sit, and I just wanted to watch baseball. And you love the colors, you love the team. And even though they kind of sucked, and good things weren't on the horizon for another couple of years, it was still baseball to me, and it was still my team. And, so dark times, but, for me, it was almost in a way that was where it all started. So I semi look back fondly, even though they were terrible.
Well said. I feel the same. I'm in lockstep with you. Getting back to the present day Mets.
Mike, can I, before we get back to the present day, actually, this is a perfect segue. I just looked up to make sure that there was no 78 uniform number. There is no 78 uniform number. However, after the fact, Patrick Mazika became the first number 76, Mike. So we'll have to talk about him on episode 176.
Well, we're going to do that right now. We're going to do that right now. Roger. Fill in the blank, but answer this or respond to it whichever way you will. Had I told you that on May 21st, the Mets would potentially field an outfield of Khalil Lee, Cameron Maybin, and John Ashwee Fargus, or even Patrick Mazika, you would have told me.
I would have told you you're absolutely insane. I mean, It was kind of funny. I think somebody – I saw somebody on Twitter made a joke, and they put up, like, the lineup from maybe 3-4 years ago, and it was similar. Like, it was, like, a bunch of – you know, look, everybody who gets in the major leagues obviously has great baseball talent. I mean, I struggle playing softball, so I can't say anything. But, yeah, sometimes you get that – you're like, oh, boy. Yeah. So I'll tell you that Lee, he's made some sick catches. He can't hit. But he's made some – I mean, the guy did – those two diving catches he made the past couple of nights were ridiculous.
They were stellar. Khalil Lee, he needs some work, Sam. A lot of people are hoping he'll make us – that, you know, hoping that he'll make us forget about Kelenic. But, I mean, your guy's Patrick Mazika. You're going to be tagged with him all season long. what do you feel about this outfield? I mean, after all, injuries are wreaking havoc right now.
It's interesting during all this that Patrick Mazika has yet to get a start. I mean, you'd think that they would have rewarded him with at least a start during all of this stuff. But it makes sense getting somebody like Cameron Maybin in here, who apparently they paid $1, and that's not even a joke. Khalil Lee, sometimes a player comes along from the minors where you seriously see that he's not there yet. Lucas Duda came around after like 45, 46 at-bats of hitting in the hundreds. And he wasn't going anywhere at the time because it was August in 2010. So he was going to get reps. Right now, Khalil Lee is going to get his reps. Is he going to adjust to specifically Major League pitching right now? I don't know whether we can say that. But I'll tell you one thing. Lucas Duda, when he was hitting in the hundies, was not making catches like Khalil Lee has made. The guy has unbelievable depth perception for getting to the ball. It's just you can tell that he picks it up immediately off of it. What's that scene in Field of Dreams when Kevin Costner says to his daughter, watch the way that Shoeless Joe takes the route? That's what, like, you, when somebody goes to the ballpark and, you know, Khalil Lee has made a little bit of a defensive mark and there's been a little bit more time other than these two catches. That's what they're going to tell their kid when pointing out to the outfield. That's how good he's been. It's been spectacular. And you know what's really funny too? That first catch, the one that was like Ron Swoboda, he actually like overshot that. He was lucky that basically what put it squarely into the web was when the glove hit the ground.
It was a little bit of an icon, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and they're both great catches, but I just wanted to point out that detail.
Well, you know, I also like to take into consideration that these guys might be playing with, you know, just a maelstrom of butterflies in their stomachs. So, well done by him. One point I'll make, John Eshwick Vargas, he won the MVP in the Puerto Rican Winter League for Caguas. You know, he has that on his resume. Glad to see him. Hope to see him back down, though, so he can continue his development. Listen to this list of names, whether – you know, they've been on for a while or they're new to the list, but, you know, we know Kevin Pillar, Jeff McNeil, Conforto, Nimmo. Pete Alonso has a situation now with his wrist. Brandon Nimmo, J.D. Davis, Guillorme, Albert Almora, Tawan Walker we mentioned, Jacob deGrom we mentioned, Seth Lugo, Carlos Carrasco is still not on a mound. We know about Dellin Betances. I don't think we should expect much from him ever again. And Syndergaard, you know, hopefully is around the corner and he'll help. But that's a long list of injured players. And yet the Mets are getting through it. And again, you know, I'll throw this around the room. Who could have foreseen us having a conversation about Jose Peraza, who got a start? Hunter, Sean, Sam, you brought up Sean Rufoli. Now they're talking about possibly bringing up Thomas Cipucki. You know, it takes a 40-man roster to win. Anywhere you want to wind this down, Roger, floor is yours.
Yeah, you know what I like about this, though, is that, you know, you like I think all the teams that we loved over the years for the Mets, and when they did make good playoff runs, you know, they were deep. And you had those role players, these guys who stepped up and did it when they had to. And you're seeing that because of all these injuries, you're seeing these guys develop already. And in a crazy way, it's kind of good to see, because then when it's crunch time and, you know, if there is a pennant race as we get towards the end of the season, then you know that these guys have already kind of, like, you know, had a little bit of a taste of the show and they'll be ready to go. And I kind of like that. Now, I wish it didn't happen, you know, in the beginning, but now that it has and there's a light at the end of the tunnel with some of the injury reports, then you kind of like, well, all right, some of these guys are getting a little bit of a shot, get a chance to see some major league pitching, get the action, or in the matter of the pitchers to face major league batters, and then maybe they're a little extra ready and not as nervous, not as many butterflies when they come back up, say, you know, end of August, September, right?
Exactly. Sam, I got a specific question for you. Which is the trend? 2-4 on this present road trip, or 11-6 in the month of May? All these injuries considered, we're up to our third and fourth string players. So, which is the trend? 2-4 or 11-6 as we head to Miami?
I'm optimistic. I'd say 11-6. The fact that they were able to bounce back from getting swept by Tampa Bay to take a series against a division rival that has kind of been that has been one of the favorites. You know, a lot of people think the Braves are going to win again, and they just haven't been able to get into any consistent play. Some of it might be, like, you know, talking about what's his name? Swanson. I forgot his first name. But was it Corey Swanson?
Don't get hung up on it.
Well,
oh,
him getting thrown out, like, yes. What was that, Roger?
Oh, Dansby Swanson?
Dansby. Not,
yeah. Well, that's not an everyday name in our neck of the woods.
That's actually a much more unique name than Corey, of course. But Dansby Swanson, like, maybe there's just moments some of these young guys, although Dansby Swanson at this point has been around for a while, are just kind of running themselves into outs. And, you know, the Mets almost swept that series. Just they weren't able to tighten up certain things at certain times. So I would say, yeah, the trend right now is resiliency. And also, to speak to the injuries, this is not just the Mets thing. This is happening around the league. And you know, of course, everybody's speculating just because of the uneven situation of last year, and that players are just trying to get their sea legs under them.
Well said. I'll just throw this out there for giggles. Against the division, Mets are 2-1 against the Braves. 1-1 against Miami, who we will now face. They are 6-3 against Philadelphia and 2-1 against Washington. Well done, boys. Well done.
Yeah.
Unless anybody has any outstanding comments or, you know, anything you want to get off your chest, going once, going twice, we will move into our final word. Roger, thank you very kindly for joining us this evening. Wonderful insight and enjoyable conversation. Again, thank you on behalf of our partner Rich and Sam. Much appreciated.
Yeah, hey, guys, it's been an honor. What a blast. Really, thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for asking, and I appreciate it. Hope we could do it again.
The pleasure is all ours. I will, Sam, initiate the final word just to give you a little sense of what we do and how we close the show. Sam?
Optimistic. I'll run with that. Last thing I said before, I am optimistic with this team. There's a lot of good feelings. Folk heroes are being created. There's a lot of personalities, and Tommy Hunter has added even more to, since the last time that I talked about him, with his first hit and just being as psyched as ever. You know, I think until he throws a perfect game, that'll be the best moment of his major league career, according to him. So we'll go from there. Yeah, you know, I'm optimistic again when Dorr is for the team. And I think everybody needs to take it easy with their hatred, their vitriol. Turn a new leaf in the way you look at free agency. Turn a new leaf with the way you look at players like this. This is not Bobby Bonilla here. You know, Francisco Lindor is not from the Bronx. So let's take it easy. Let's enjoy the baseball we're seeing now. And let's go Mets.
Roger Clark, reporter for New York One News. Thank you so very kindly this evening for your time. Sir,
thank God.
I will ask you for your final word.
All right. So I cheated a little here because I like Sam's optimistic, and I Googled synonyms for optimistic, and this one came up, and I think it's hilarious, so I'm going to use it. It's buoyant, believe it or not, means cheerful and optimistic. So I am buoyant about this season. Last night I was sitting in my room watching the game when they started to come back, even though they lost, and I yelled out to my son in the other room. I said, "This is the team. This is the team." So, if that's any indication, and my wife's like, "All right, shut up, enough." But yeah, buoyant. I'm buoyant. Yeah. I don't even know how to spell it, but I am buoyant.
And I will use.
There's a Y in there somewhere, I think.
There's a Y, there's a U, yeah, a lot of vowels.
I will reuse one of our earlier words, resiliency. I'm enjoying the fight. I'm enjoying the grit. I'm looking forward to the dogfights with the division rivals in the dog days of summer. I think it's going to be interesting. I think we're just going to spend a couple of months just battering our brains out, you know, and it ought to be fun. Hopefully health is on the way. And I'll just leave it at that. I'm in lockstep with you gentlemen, optimistic. I like the resiliency. I like the fight. At any given time this month, they could have just, you know, given up with all the adversity and everything going wrong, but they haven't. So that's good to see. And you got to credit Rojas for some of that as well. They all seem to be on the same page.
And I'll add that you are starting to see, like, you got it in terms of the new ownership. You know, you're not going to be able to completely shake off who the Mets are right away. And we may not be completely able to, as optimistic as I am this season. But at the same time, you are sensing the big differences. The really minute differences, but they're major as to who's running this team. And just wanted to throw that out there because we should, you know, this is the first May 20th. This is the first May 21st or whatever the date is right now of Steve Cohen's Mets career. So, you know, let's enjoy that and hopefully continue to build on this.
Well, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. That's cliche. He still hasn't completed his first year yet. I'm optimistic, obviously. But there's still work to do, and I don't expect it all to be done before the summer's through. This is a work in progress. Roger, I will ask you this final question then, because you remember when Nelson Doubleday and the Wilpons came in and purchased the team from Linda DeRoulet and the Payson Estate. Once upon a time, we looked upon the Wilpons as saviors back in 1980. It didn't evolve that way. How do you feel about new ownership? What's your opinion?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, the Payson family, you know, Joan Payson especially was beloved. And then when, you know, she went away and, you know, the family kept running it, but, you know, they ran into the ground and Donald Grant and all that stuff. So then when Nelson Doubleday came in, and I think I remember thinking how cool it was that he was a Doubleday because baseball, Doubleday, you know. So and it turned out pretty good. Fast forward, yeah. In the end, it was time for them to go. You know, it was time for that to end because it just wasn't working. It wasn't sustainable. You can't have a fan base that's that loyal and that passionate not have a quality product on the field,
and they didn't care about the product as far as I was concerned. So, you know, to go to the ballpark and spend, you know, all kinds of money and, you know, take my son and, you know, you walk out of there, you spend $200 or something and then see a crap product. It's not worth it. You know, I think that this guy wants people like us to go to the ballpark. And even if we're overspending for hot dogs and beer, we're walking out of there with a smile on our face because we saw a good team. You know, we saw a good product. And I think that, and I do think that that's what he wants, you know.
Well done. Well said by you. Sam, it's my habit. I hand it off to you. Take us home.
Let's get this going. This team looks good. You know, they're working out the kinks. As we said, we're optimistic. Love New York City. Thank you, Roger. Let's go Mets. Thanks, Mike. Take care, everybody.
Good night, all. Thank you, Roger.
Good night. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Good night, all.